few days ago, in the midst of one of those heavy talks where people ask the big solemn questions, someone wanted to know what it took to be happy. And of several answers to that question, mine seemed to be somewhat eccentric. It was one word, gratitude. There was a minister present who clearly thought that was an odd thing to say, so he asked, "What do you think makes a good Christian?" I said, "Gratitude." And then it had to be explained, which is what the sermon is about this morning. I'm sure that like most truths we live by, this one is partial and not absolute. But I take it very seriously. To be happy or to be good, you have to feel grateful. If it sounds strange to link goodness and gratitude that closely, at least it isn't new. A Roman statesman who died 50 years before Christ was born did exactly that. For him, grateful and good were synonyms. And he held gratitude in such high regard that he even called it the mother of virtues. For him, a grateful mind is a happy one. And a happy mind is the mother of good things. I believe that. Another Roman living at the same time as Christ felt the same way and wondered why people shouldn't have a constant sense of gratitude. If we can be thankful for sudden surprises, for an unexpected gift, why shouldn't we be thankful all the time for the miracle of being alive at all? For work, and for vacations from it, for friendship, health, opportunity. In that case, gratitude would always be present. And you don't find unhappy, despondent people among the grateful. I have a theory that's probably as wrong as some others that appeal to me, but I can at least give you the pleasure of disputing it. I believe that when you encounter sullen, unenthusiastic kids in school, they are strangers to the feeling of gratitude. They've had no reason. Apparently, because they take so much for granted. They're not quite sure what they should be grateful for. Did they have so much so easily that there never was any reason to feel grateful? I don't know. It's probably much more complex than that. But in my experience, grateful children are happy children. Someone said, "He who remembers the benefits of his parents is too much occupied with his recollections to remember their faults." Gratitude, I think, is a matter of how one chooses to look at life, far more than it is a matter of logic. Some people concentrate on how much they have to do for others. Some concentrate on how much others have done for them. And logically, they can both support the way they see things. And yet the decision to concentrate on one or the other makes all the difference in the world as to what kind of people we become. One of the Shakespeare comedies makes the point extremely well. There is a grouch in As You Like It, who wants to be miserable, who translates everything he sees into a reason to be miserable. But there is another character in the same setting who not only is grateful for the good things, but can even find some blessing hidden in misfortune. They've all been banished from the city life of the courts to the woods, where they are in some danger. But he chooses to say, "And this our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in the running streams, sermons in stones, and good in everything." His old best friend replies, "Happy is your grace that can translate the stubbornness of fortune into so quiet and so sweet a style." Two men caught in the same circumstances translate them differently. Have you ever thought that translation is what we spend our lives doing? For the most part, we all read the same great book from our arrival to our leaving, but our translations are not alike and lead us in the direction either of happiness or misery. I get a bad knee and have to limp for 6 months, complaining all the while. Someone else loses a leg, regrets it, turns her attention to all that is left to be grateful for and is sunny. The difference is that I concentrate on what I have lost. She concentrates on what she has left. Those who find reason to be grateful like to express their gratitude with a word or some kind of marker. The Hebrew scripture has a good story about one of those moments and one of those monuments to gratitude, a story that comes from a time when the Jewish people were having one of their endless battles with the Philistines. It was probably not a fair fight, since the Philistines had swords and spears and the poor Israelites had only sticks and stones, but just at a crucial moment, according to the story, the Lord thundered loud and long over the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they stampeded like cattle. How are we supposed to read that? Well, my guess is that a terrifying thunderstorm hit at a lucky moment and was taken to be a clear sign of God's helpful intervention. That isn't a literal interpretation. So do I have any right to make it? Any evidence to support it? And the answer is yes. Thunder is said to be the voice of God in many places in the Old Testament. The 29th Psalm is typical as it describes a storm. The God of glory thunders. His voice makes the oak trees dance and strips the forest bare. There's the wind. The voice of the Lord flashes forth flames of fire. And there's the lightning. Now, since everything that happened in nature was thought to be God's direct doing, Samuel figured when the storm hit at just the right moment, it was a good time to be grateful. So he set up a marker, a stone to celebrate God's help and to show his gratitude, and it was called an Ebenezer. It means stone of help, which reminds me that some of the members of this choir in another church once sang a hymn with a line in it that says, "Here I raise my Ebenezer." They had absolutely no idea what that meant. So they asked for an explanation from their resident Bible student. "Here I raise my Ebenezer" means, "Here I express in some way or other my thanks to God for what he has done." Did Samuel really think that the eternal God himself jumped up a thunderstorm just to help him out? Or was he simply the kind of man who could hear the voice of God in all sorts of natural events? Remember the Shakespeare character I mentioned a few minutes ago out in the forest of Arden, who said that even there one could find tongues in trees? What an odd translation that is. Trees have no tongues. Photosynthesis, yes, and lignin and cambium layers, but no tongues. Except, of course, that they have tongues. They speak to us if we have enough poetry in us to hear them. You've had a message on a spring day when the buds show their first pale and tender green, and you know with a leap of the heart what season has come. There is always a voice somewhere, even in darkness, that says there is still some reason to be grateful. How you express your gratitude will depend on how you've been taught. Some people come to church because they are thankful and because it has been part of their past to express that feeling to God in songs and in prayers and in fellowship with other grateful people. Old Samuel, having been taught a certain way, set up an Ebenezer, a marker of stone, not just because of his fleeting victory over the Philistines, but to signal a faith more profound than that. Something deep inside him believed in destiny under God. And if to someone else there was only a well-timed summer storm, Samuel saw it with the eyes of faith and gratitude, and it was time for a celebration. The chances for being grateful are so many that if you're willing, you can find them. Even something so apparently prosaic as reading a book can give you the opportunity. A new idea jumps off the page, clears something up for you about life. "Thank you," you say to the author. The library of books we call the Bible is certainly not always exciting, but I've had moments of discovery that made me want to put up a memorial to the author who preserved a story for me. I'm grateful for a little story that gives me a special insight into the personality of Christ. It was that day when the prim and proper Pharisees had surprised some poor woman with her lover and dragged her out into the public square so that all the good people could stone her to death and go home feeling closer to God. I don't know what she had on, maybe a robe snatched up in a hurry, but they were really dressed up for the occasion. Dressed, I mean, in all the self-righteous piety they could get their hands on. Layers and layers of it. They stared at her with bold, uncompromising eyes, supremely confident that the world had just then split into clear-cut good and evil, and that there was no doubt at all about which side they were on. I'm sure the woman could not even look at anyone, close to fainting from humiliation and fear. I think Jesus couldn't bear to look at either side, at her in her misery, or at those gloating faces in their triumph and in their total lack of compassion. For a while, I'm not sure he could even trust himself to speak. So he stooped down. It is one of the oddest and most memorable moments in all of Scripture. He stooped down and wrote something on the ground. Nobody knows what it was. A word, a sentence, or just doodling. Maybe he simply wanted silence to settle in for a while. Then he straightened himself up for as long as he could bear to look at the leering faces, and he said, "Let the one who is without sin go ahead now and throw the first stone." And then he knelt down and did a little more writing or doodling and waited. And in that moment, while he waits, I like this child of God better than I would think possible for someone I never met in the flesh. In one stroke, he has done two things. Transferred some of that woman's embarrassment to those who would judge her, and given them, in his mercy, a chance to examine their hearts and perhaps still to enter the kingdom of right relationships. What happened was that they began slowly to walk away. Away from the heartless piety that would have killed her, into some quiet place where they could say, each one to himself, "We hope. Good God, what in the world am I doing? Judging that woman when the truth is that I have done the same, or wish to do the same, or something worse, and therefore ought to know when the law must be tempered with mercy." They went away one by one, the story says, starting with the oldest. That's a curious observation. Maybe only an accident, but I wonder if it may mean something. Did the oldest leave first because for them the years had worn their crust of certainty just a little thinner? Was it because they had had so much more time to do wrong or think wrong, and they had a whole catalog of those things to reflect upon? And suddenly, remembering all of that, they are ashamed now of their hypocrisy with this woman and can hardly wait to get away from those clear eyes that are looking through them. I don't know, but off they go. And if ever God is in a moment, surely he is in that one. Can you imagine the gratitude in that woman's heart for what the sensitive rabbi had done? And the story's gift to me, 2,000 years later, well, I can tell you what that is. In that single short story, there is a model of how we are meant to respond to weakness, to misplaced love, to self-righteous condemnation. And I'm grateful for that moment of insight into the mind of Christ, who knelt in the dirt and waited while the presence of God came into that moment and blessed it. In some way, if we have eyes to see, if we can read the book, or the friend's face, or the meaning of the moment, something like that will happen this week to each one of us and give us cause to be grateful.